I'm for Gene Shepherd, humorist, after-dinner speaker, and recipient of the Mark Twain Award for 1976. Here's Gene.
Set up in there, huh?
All right. Get ready with it now. We're going to use it.
Hooray.
Oh, no. Into each life. Something must fall. What the hell was it? Into each life. It's right on the tip of my head there. Right on the very tip of my point. Into each life. Son of a gun. I knew what that was. It's one of those things I know. You know, if you ask me, what time the 827 IRT arrives, I could tell you right away. 9:48. I mean, sure, you've never taken the IRT, then you don't know that. What time the 512 to Darien leaves? Well, I'd say about 6:15. Let me see here. Into each life something must fall. But would you please give me a cheer and a blast of applause and accompanying music for man's imperfect mind, please? You mind if I get out my my axe here? What's the matter? Well, you know, you just can't. There's no substitute in the end, friends, for talent. And you can do it all you want. You can holler. Hey, by the way, would you please, if you will, excuse me, Carl? Hey, Carl. Not that one. Reset in there, if you will, one of my great solos, Semper Fidelis. It's on that same cut, the same disc in there. And you like that? Well, I'll tell you. I'll have to explain something here to you. As an ex-bass player, and by the way, among all the instruments in the orchestra and the band, the one that requires one of the most accurate ears is the bass. Requires a great ear, and it requires a great sense of beat, and it also requires total humility, because it's a difficult instrument to play, the sousaphone. Not just because it doesn't take any... By the way, most people think it takes a lot of wind to play it. Not at all. In fact, it takes, among the wind instruments, the least amount of wind. Don't confuse the size with the amount of pressure it takes. In fact, you know what instrument takes the most wind to play, really, among the brass instruments? Would be the peckhorn, or the French horn, you probably call it. It's called the peckhorn among orchestra people, and it takes a fantastic amount of wind. Not really wind, but it takes a very carefully controlled embouchure. You know what is an embouchure? Well, okay, that's that little hallway that you come into in those elegant salons. That's the embouchure where you check your hat and all. However, it takes a very very finely controlled embouchure to play a peckhorn. On the other hand, another instrument takes a lot of wind. It would be, I would say, basically the trumpet. A trumpet is a mean instrument. It tears hell out of your lips. It just blows you right off the... Now, playing a sousaphone or a tuba, two different instruments, by the way, which may confuse most people who tend to think of anything as a bass horn, but the tuba is the instrument that is upright. It is not carried in parades. A sousaphone is, however, carried in parades. That's the instrument that is carried over the shoulder. They're basically the same instrument. However, they do have slightly different sound. There's a slightly different quality to them. The sousaphone, this is a personal observation, is easier in some ways to play. It has a larger circumference of tubing and so on. Curiously enough, the smaller uprights get tough. I mean, you start playing the E-flat upright. That's a mean little mother and tough to play. And it's the quality of getting the sound. That's where the difficulty of playing this instrument comes in. Getting the proper sound, getting the phrasing is a better way to put it. And so as a sousaphone player, at one point, I did a specialty with this big concert band that I was with. I used to perform on the kazoo with the orchestra, with the band, in concert. Sure. Not as a funny ha-ha, but as an illustration to show how one small instrument can alter the whole sound of a great band or a great musical art. You know, they say that if you play, that this is why you don't hear many... classical compositions. When I say classical, serious music compositions, not necessarily classical, because classical, by the way, means a certain period in time. But you don't hear many composers use a saxophone in the orchestra. Now, you know why this is so? Well, the saxophone has a curious quality to it, and it was invented, incidentally, by a Frenchman. And his name was Sax, S-A-X-E. And it is an instrument that overrides and overshadows and, in fact, completely colors the entire sound of the orchestra. Which means that if you write a piece of music, let's say an orchestral suite, for argument's sake, and you write into it a part for a saxophone, let's say an alto or a tenor sax, as a legitimate instrument. It comes out when you actually play it as if you have an alto sax or a tenor sax accompanied by an orchestra. Well, now that's not what you're looking for. You want it to be part of the orchestra, but it just doesn't. It overshadows an orchestra completely when it's used. That's why when people begin to talk about jazz bands, when the word jazz came in the 1900s, early 1900s, they were primarily referring to a sound of an orchestra that had with it a saxophone, which gave it a whole different coloration. It was a different sound. I don't know why I got into this. This is whole totally a field of playing the kazoo. But a kazoo will do the same thing. If you take a kazoo in the middle of a 200-piece orchestra, everybody hears the kazoo. You could have four guys playing string basses in the back there. You have 17 trombones. All that. What do you hear? The kazoo. Okay? Now, I'll give you an example of that. Let's go. No. I don't want to cheer. It's okay. Let's go. It's got to be all the way up, Carl. Okay, now there's an illustration that no matter what you do with the orchestra, you're going to hear that damn kazoo. So it's a very cutting, it's a very cutting sound. Now, another instrument that's very similar to that in the way of overriding an orchestra in a way is the guitar. Believe it or not, a guitar is a very simple little instrument, you know, and it doesn't seem to have much guts, really. That a guitar played properly in the middle of a band or orchestra will sound... You sit in the back, 5,000 rows back, and say, what's that guitar? You know, you don't even know that all the sousaphones and the tubas and everybody else is blowing their dinghies out, and you don't hear them. Do you want to hear some more of that band? Now, this, by the way, happens to be a great band record. Let's just hear a little more of it, Carl. You don't have to reset it. Just let it go wherever it is. Just start the machine, and wherever it is, it'll sound good, okay? Now, listen to that section work. Now, that's section work. Okay, now, I'll give you a tip on playing the kazoo if you're interested in playing this instrument. First of all, listen. Always listen. Because the kazoo is an instrument that's necessarily dependent on the ear. Not the mouth, the ear. Reset that, Carl, please. While I'm talking here, you reset it. If you play your kazoo with, make sure you're consistent to begin with. Don't play the melody, because the melody, in the case of this piece of music, is played at alternate times by various instruments. Not one instrument plays the whole melody. So you may find the trumpets at one point are playing the melody. The next moment you hear the bass section is playing the melody. You know, this is the bass section. So you have to pick what section you're going to play. If you play them all, you're not playing anything. Would you please, if you will, listen carefully to me. You'll find over there, you'll find a thing, that record that Little Lee brought in. Okay? If you will look carefully at it, you will find a thing that is entitled Frogs. Bog. Okay. You're a very literal lady. You know that. All right, put it on there. I'll show you what I'm going to do with that. And before, and while Carl's in there flailing around with the machines, I will. I would like to salute, for those of you who wonder what's happening out there in the country. You know, a lot of people say, well, nothing happens out there. You know, anything beyond Manhattan, there's just no excitement. Well, I have a little item here, which I think ultimately is going to go into our vast file of trivia here, so that when people of future times know what our society was really like, okay? It's a wedding announcement. Now, wedding announcements could be very dull, right? You know, the description of what the bride wore, and the description of the last company that the bridegroom was fired from, and the description of the bride's father and the bride's mother, and a little brief description that the groom's father just left Leavenworth, and various things like that. You know, it's very dull. All right, here, listen to this one. I just like to. I will not tell you what town it is. It doesn't matter. Nor will I give you the real name. Okay. All right. Let's take this name. We'll just pick a name, huh? Okay. Marcia Johnson, daughter of Mrs. George Johnson of Chicago, Illinois, and Paul Watanabe, son of Dr. and Mrs. Ralph Watanabe of Floral Park, were married on Saturday at the church. Given in marriage by her father, the bride wore a white gauze dress with crochet trim and a white satin sash. She carried a bouquet of white and yellow daisies and wore a crown of baby's breath. Up to that point, we're still with it, right? Classic, huh? Okay, it gets better. The couple had no attendants except their dog, Walker, who accompanied them throughout the ceremony as best dog. A cocktail hour and reception was held at the home of the bridegroom's parents. After the ceremony, relatives and friends from Illinois, Connecticut, and Vermont attended, as well as another dog, Fred, and the family duck, Albert. Mr. Watanabe is a graduate of the University of Illinois and works in the office of the paper here in town. Mr. Watanabe attended Middlebury College in Vermont and earned a graduate degree from Indiana University. Oh, we're very proud. He's one of our fellow alumni, and I hope he and the best dog there got along fine. I wonder if the best dog, passed the ring up to him and did all that stuff. And there's a picture, incidentally, on the paper, in the paper, of the ceremony. It's a very touching ceremony. You see the a beautiful picture. It's a classic picture. You see the reverend in the church and the lady wearing her white bridal gown, and there's the man standing there. Mr. Watanabe is standing there looking very official. And below them is the best dog. Okay. That's right. It's sponsored by Elpo. We're on our way, friends. We're on our way. All right, now, have a note here. I'm going to leave the world of the kazoo here. Just have to do it, friends. Sometimes you just give them... You always, by the way, if you're a kazoo player, always leave them wanting more. You know the trouble with most amateur kazoo players is that they inflict the instrument on people. This is not, believe me, Isaac Stern does not run around every party he goes playing his fiddle, laughing and yelling and eating peanuts, I can tell you that. He does not. So if you want to have your instrument respected, respect the instrument. Use it properly. Use it only when it is called for. Okay? This is even more true of the jew's harp. Because, by the way, very few people can play the jew's harp, although everybody who owns one believes he can. I'm continually getting letters from guys who say, I can play the jew's harp, put it in you! And then when you hear one of these poor sad saps, he goes plunk, 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 you know, he stands there with a dumb look. It sounds like he has a mouth of A&W root beer as he's trying to play. All right, now, I received a note here from somebody who says, Shepherd, would you please tell us in your own words what time of year do you enjoy the most? It's a good question. Nobody asks, no, not summer. Mm-mm. Nobody asks Johnny Carson good stuff like that. No. You know, I'll tell you, a lot depends on what happened to you when you were a kid. It really does. Almost everything in our life is colored by what happened to us as children. People tend to think of children as a separate race. They are not. And I have to take issue with Rex Reed, who recently did a review of a Truffaut film, and he talked about children as if he were talking about puppies or dogs, as if it's a separate... No, Rex, children are us, and we are children. If children are resilient, so are people, Rex, because the child is the father of the man. May I be filled with fantastic cliches here. However, it is true that we were all children and are all still children in one way or another. Now, people who confuse children with childhood, this is the bad problem. In other words, if you're still living the life of childhood and you're 22, you're in real trouble. Real trouble. However, to expunge the child from you is an impossibility. That's like expunging 10 years of your life. You cannot expunge any years of your life. They're always with you. And they will affect you. And I'll tell you, when I was talking about the weather... See, I was into sports. Now, I don't mean sports in the sense of skiing. That's not really the thing that I would call sport. It's a pastime. Sport, I mean sports. Competitive. And I played football. Now, most guys I knew did. I mean, you know, you tend to get friends around you who are like you. And so I played football all through high school. High school football. And we would go out in the middle of August. And for spring, not spring really, but fall training. It was to get the team ready for the season, which began roughly the 15th of September, something like that. And we would go out like the 1st of August. Well, it was during that period that I grew to hate August. Well, I don't know whether you've ever done 150 push-ups in 100-degree temperature wearing shoulder pads. You tend to not look upon August with favor. You used to hate August coming along. And also, you ached. Oh, my God. Oh, we would do laps, and we would do push-ups, and we would do squat and bends. We would do the famous bicycle rock. That's a goodie. You know how that one's done, don't you? Lay flat on your stomach, and you rock back and forth like a rocker, back and forth, back and forth. Of course, remember, we're not doing it for fun and games like your average jogger. We are wearing pads. We are wearing the works. Well, it gets to be very boring. Boredom. Heat, yelling. I always had splinters under my fingernails. See, because these are the little things you pick up playing football. I always had constant scabs here and there and everywhere. Constant things that ached and little things that hurt. And you couldn't eat the stuff that everybody else was eating. You know, we'd go down to the local equivalent of McDonald's, and everybody be having the Big Mac, you know, and you'd say, well, give me, So, it's not good. Okay, but then playing was different. And so you played and played, and all the season went by, and it would rain, and it would get hot, and it would rain, it would get cold. And then as the season progressed, it got fantastically cold. I can remember playing games of football in 5, 10, 15 degree below zero temperatures with the wind, because this is Green Bay country I'm talking about. This is not Shea Stadium. The wind howling out of the north. And the ground so frozen that when you ran over it, you could actually hear your football shoes going thunk, 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 thunk. You were like running on a billiard table. And when you landed on it, you were landing on a billiard table. It was mean. So time would go by. And finally, we would play our last game around Thanksgiving. I have seen it so cold and so much snow and ice that they had to clear the field. And when you would run out of bounds, you would run into a 3-foot, 5-foot drift sometimes. You know, oh, God, I hated that. Well, then the winter set in. Ice and snow, mean. And it would come screaming out of the north every night. And the ice would never go. The gray skies. I guess that's another thing you people don't know about out here. But in very large parts of the Middle West, they do not see the sky from roughly, October to possibly April. They see no blue sky at all. It's just one big solid gray cover over it. That's called winter cover, by the way, is what it's called. Wind blowing. Once in a while we would have a day where we did see the sun, and then it would drop to 25 below. The minute the sky gets clear, by the way, it gets infinitely colder because the sky, that big flat gray, keeps the sun, you know, keeps the heat in, and then it would come. You ready over there? It would come. March, early March. There is no feeling, friends, like going out on a ball field. The first spring days. Smelling that grass growing and hearing the sound of somebody hitting fungo fly balls. Just that pop of the ball. And you just trot around out in the outfield and smell the grass. And once in a while, you chase a long fly. It doesn't hurt like football. It's a whole different set of muscles come into play. And then you begin to throw those short throws into second base, getting your arm in shape. And then you take your turn at bat. You start fouling off a few. Taking those swings at a batting practice pitcher that's throwing him in easy because he's getting his arm ready, too. Just no time like those first early spring days on a ball field. And anybody who has never experienced it will never understand baseball. It's grass. It's a new season. It's the smell of the river in the distance and the swamp and the sound of the frogs. That's baseball, early spring. My favorite time of the year. Very early spring. You may even find a little ice under the grandstand here and there. Yeah, and you wear a sweatshirt to warm up in. Yeah. And that hurt in the palm. You haven't caught a ball all year, and your palm hurts from getting those first few hard throws, and it swells. Your glove has that smell of not being used all winter. You rub oil into it. It's a fantastic feeling. Okay, you ask a question, you get an answer, right, kid? You mean you've never smelled the smell of a well-broken-in outfielder's glove? You know, outfielder's gloves, incidentally, smell different. They have a different smell entirely from an infielder's mitt. You know why, don't you? Well, you don't. They're held differently. You think they just put the glove on like you put on your gloves? Are you kidding? You ever watch the first baseman put his glove on? That's right. Catcher's mitt has a smell like no other mitt. What kind of a glove does a pitcher use? Does he use a glove that's similar to an outfielder? Or does he use a glove similar to an infielder? You know that the third baseman's glove is different from a shortstop's glove. Oh, yes. Indeed. Joe Morgan, for example, the second baseman of the Reds, uses a very small glove. He's a throwback to earlier great infielders like Honus Wagner. But he uses a small glove. Gives him a certain kind of Joe Morgan mobility. Other players use a much larger glove. The first baseman's glove, by the way, is closer in philosophy to a catcher's mitt. It does not have fingers, to begin with, if you don't know anything about that. It's a scooping glove. And now, what about an outfielder? What kind of a glove does he use? No, 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 no.
You've been listening to Gene Shepherd, humorist, author, and recipient of the Mark Twain Award for 1976.